we'll get started, members, and we had a bit of a problem, and I'll explain that in a minute, but we do have some coffee, and there are some other breakfast rolls and stuff over there, too, if you'd like. The problem is, and I probably could have...
Mr. Chair, maybe we will call this the curse of Bill Gates.
Yeah. The curse of Bill Gates, and I know exactly what that is because that happened to me, too. What we're going to end up doing, we have to change the presentation, and that's the curse of Bill Gates, which is we lost the presentation, right?
Mr. Chair, I think what we did was, as Ms. McQuay and I were emailing the presentation back and forth and doing edits, we accidentally saved it in a temporary file, which when we logged back on this morning no longer existed. So it'll take us a couple hours to just recreate some of the final edits, and we plan to give it to you on Thursday, and we'll try to do a quick version so we don't waste too much more of your time. But I think your intent was to maybe talk in general terms about some of the paper we have in front of you today.
Yes, and that's my curse of Bill Gates was that we have actually it wasn't curse of Bill Gates, it was curse of Dell Computer. We lost the hard drive this summer, and we keep our business, the Two Fools Winery business, on hard drive and do on QuickBooks Pro, which is a program we use, and we lost the whole works. And we had been using a internet backup service, which automatically backs everything up. And when we went to re-piece everything, it didn't work as well as we had hoped. So now we have not only a backup service, but we also have an external hard drive to back up the hard drive. So those are problems that I guess happen. But what I'd like to do is take a little bit of time this morning, because you took the effort of coming, and talk about E12 budget or E12 budgeting. And just want to emphasize that we have a significant budget problem, a very significant budget problem, and one that and I appreciate the governor's comments about his efforts to protect K-12, but what I want to put out is to you is that if you take the E-12 budget, which is roughly about 40% of our state general fund budget, and you take the health and human service budget, which is about 28% of the general fund budget, you have a significant amount of our overall budget, which is about roughly 68%. So you look at a deficit, which I think is probably going to be updated by the time we really get into the budgeting solving part of it, of probably somewhere between, I think the estimate on the forecast was $4.8 billion, which does not include inflation, which is another $650 million. And then if that gets more serious, you could be looking at a range of 5 to maybe $7 billion, you know, dollars in a deficit. So if you take and look at how is this legislature going to balance a budget with that type of a deficit, we really have to be serious about looking under every rock, looking under how we might be able to reinvent the delivery of services, and it becomes even more difficult when you see that roughly that E12 and higher or E12 and the health and human service budget is basically a pass-through type budget. So most of the money that we appropriate goes directly out to buy services in one way or another, educational services, health and human services, health and human type services. And so that makes it doubly difficult because it's not like you can eliminate, balance the budget. Somebody on the floor said, let's cut our stamp allowance, and we probably should have. But, that we're going to balance the budget 42 cents at a time.
Right.
Well, that's true. I mean, every bit helps, but I think it doesn't get at the magnitude of the problem that we're really facing. And so that's kind of a lead-in to what I'd like to just take, and we definitely won't have to stay here the full period because we, I think, can get into this discussion, but I really think that it's an opportunity to try to get ideas and obviously staff will give us information on different aspects of the budget, but to take advantage of this and look for just a sharing of information. So I'm going to turn it over to Senator Michelle.
While Mr. Nauman gets his notes ready, I guess along the lines of your topic of what big things are out there, what things are being discussed, we can look to what some of the other states are doing because we're all in this budget mess. And it does make you raise your eyebrows. The governor of New York has proposed a 3% K-12 cut, so a real cut. And California, I just read, I don't think they're going to go this way, but one of the proposals out there is to actually reduce the school year by a week. So, yeah, you may not get there with 42 cents at a time, but some of these other things that at least other states are talking about are pretty big and would net you big dollars, but would obviously have a huge impact on the system and what we want to do. So I think the sooner we start talking about this, the better. Thanks for giving us a little more of the math.
Great.
That's a good question. Mr. Nauman.
And Mr. Maybe just talking about other states and the temperature's only going to get warmer in these committee rooms. But some states, I believe it's the governor of Indiana, who had initiative that school districts that might not be at a certain size would look at consolidation. But when you go into rural areas and you talk about the struggle for survival, it might look a little self-righteous for some of us in St. Paul to prescribe these things. But any thoughts in general about those states, and there's others that have looked at districts pairing. It was very controversial for Senator Bardoff just to talk about shared services, but in terms of the number of districts, the number of municipalities, townships, etc., and this really gets at rural area, and I respect that, but it's got to be in the back of our minds, and as we look at complications in a school formula based on all of these entities and nuances, just reflections in general on that subject is.
Well, since I've been here in the legislature, which is in 1980, we've had several cycles of consolidation programs that were instituted to try to facilitate consolidation, things like cooperation and consolidation, pairing and sharing. These were pretty well different programs, but many of them are still on statute. And when I look across my district, which has changed over the years, many of the districts have moved to sharing superintendents, two and three districts. administrative kind of reductions. The most dramatic one was under then Commissioner Gene Mamangate, which was under Governor Perpich. At that time, he had proposed to consolidate the 50 smallest districts in the state. Was it 50? I don't think it was 50. It was like about, it was more than that. But so we did some checking on that and actually found out that by doing that, the savings was very minimal, but it drove the distance out immensely, so that there would be a lot of extra transportation costs that involved. But we did have a discussion earlier about online learning, technology, kinds of innovative things, and I think that's something that the governor is interested in. I know he's mentioned it in relationship to higher ed. So I think everything needs to be on the table, and obviously it'll be up to us to try to sort through whether it's reasonable and possible and workable. But I agree wholeheartedly with, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but somebody mentioned it, I don't think the public is up to or knows about the immensity of this deficit and the immensity of the economy and what is happening to people's jobs or lack of, or, you know, getting laid off, cutbacks, the scenario will be spelled out over time, but I really think that's probably our biggest hurdle, is to try to get people to come to understand where we are, and that's tough, very tough. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as somebody already has mentioned, that's what talk about trying to educate our people back home. We had the reaction we got to Senator Bonner's bill was unbelievable. I mean, they don't believe it either, so how are they going to get the people back home to do it? We need some serious education of this community that meets around us, too.
Mm-hmm. Senator Salzman.
That's a good point. I have Mr. Nauman's sore throat today.
I apologize.
But I think what's really hard here is that there is the budget deficit. But I think what we're all hearing is from our constituents. It's what's happening to families, and people who have never struggled are now all of a sudden confronting job loss. And on the way in today, I was talking with a constituent who said they've already cut back to 4 days a week. And he said, if this continues, I'll be laying off 10 people by the end of the month. And I think that's another part of this. But also, we talked about in our business committee yesterday that our way out of this is also to grow jobs. And that's where I think education has a very important point. But I agree with Senator Saxog that as I left the meeting, I want to thank Senator Bonner for really listening to all the testimony. But at the same time, I was thinking, if you think this is tough, wait until we go to other topics that we all need to come to the table and really discuss this. So I think that's the message I'm sending back to the different organizations, that we're in this together. It would be better if we try to work together on like solutions than us feeling as if anything we come up with is going to be unpopular with some group. So I think, Bonoff, I think all of us want to just continue the discussion. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for perspective, when some of the clearing and sharing and some of the other things were done, was there money for incentives that we don't have now to help bring these districts together? I mean, that's really what we're lacking now is money to give them an incentive to do this.
Back then, many of those programs were not necessarily tied to a deficit. A lot of those programs were, happened sometimes because the reality of the situation, rural districts needed to come together because of declining enrollment, things like that. But yes, most of those programs were tied to some type of an incentive, either to address the personnel issues or to address the governance issues. Many times when you put school districts together, that becomes a problem. It helps. Reforms, it helps to have some money to spend because you can kind of make things a little bit easier to swallow that way. Well, let's learn more about the budget, Mr. Nolan.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, much of this unscripted conversation you've heard, and then maybe there might be some questions that you all would have of us. I'll just make some general comments and see if I'm going the direction you'd like to go. We have some paper in front of you that at some point I'd like to at least take the opportunity so we don't have to reprint them and give you a sense of what that paper is. But it might be helpful since you're interested in having a conversation about the budget to maybe contextualize what we were confronting at the beginning of December when the forecast came out. The deficit for the current year, that's the end of the 08-09 biennium, was $426 million. There was $155 million in the reserve, which the governor, according to law, needed to have a joint advisory committee with the legislature. They convened that meeting, and then they recaptured that money. That dropped the deficit down, and then they made unallotments to get it down to zero. Now, I've heard testimony with respect to this year that suggests that because of the nature of this forecast, which is a little bit unique in that at the point in which we were the agencies were making the forecast, things still looked pretty good. It was a projected forecast. They were looking at the future data that were indicating that things were projected to dramatically fall off the table. And in fact, just a day or so ago, we saw that in fact the revenues are beginning to tail off. They've already begun to tail off, but we're seeing that the trend continued. The January collections were down $131 million relative to forecast. So that is beginning to bear out some of the trends that they were anticipating in the forecast. What does that mean for the current biennium? I would suggest that it probably means that in February we're going to see a further adjustment downwards, which might mean more unallotments. We no longer have a reserve, so any shortfall in order to end up at balance either means the legislature has to act quickly or the governor would have to unallot. Now, you're in session, so you can act to deal with the current budget. I would suggest that the bigger risk becomes as we move closer to the end of the year. If the trend continues and we haven't made sufficient cuts, if we cut back to zero down in at the end of the February forecast, but the trend continues and we continue to lose revenues relative to the spending, that would argue that we could be in for some continued adjustments for the current biennium at the end of the legislative session. Just a little bit unique. We haven't had to deal with that, at least in my memory. So that's the current biennium. The next biennium is projected to be in November, $4.8 billion, and the tail is a comparable number. Now, just in nominal terms, those numbers are relatively close to the number. They're a little bit larger than the numbers that we saw in the 2003 session. So why the big difference? Well, you all have identified it. The economy is in a much different place now than it was then. Everybody's hurting. We weren't an island then, of course. Everyone was feeling some pain in 2003. But it is a different circumstance. We're seeing lots of layoffs, as you all have talked about. So that's the forecast. Of course, I would anticipate that the numbers get a bit larger in February as well for the out years. And the State Budget Trends Commission was recently completed, and that report, I believe, went public yesterday. The Star Tribune spoke about it today. They have a few recommended solutions in terms of broadening bases of taxes and stabilizing revenues and those kinds of measures that the legislature may wish to take a look at. Of particular interest to this committee, I think it's important to highlight that we are at about 40% in this biennium in terms of overall spending on the general fund in education. That number does go down in the next biennium. Why? Primarily the expansion of the human services side. They're growing faster than we are. So the percentages change a little bit. So hypothetically, and we'll give you some of these charts on Thursday to talk about the context. If you think about our share of the total, it's about a share of the shortfall. It's about $1.8 billion. So how would you take $1.8 billion out of the budget? Well, you could make reductions to the formula, make big cuts. We're about 82% of our state budget in education, 82% of the total education budget is general fund or general education monies. You add special ed and it grows close to 90. So these are monies that are going directly to districts. So what that does is reduce your flexibility to, if you will, keep it out of the classroom. If hypothetically that's the kind of cut that we're looking at. I'm not presuming that is. But this committee has levers, as I've mentioned to you on many occasions, that other committees don't have. You have, we have a payment schedule, we have property taxes, all of which provide opportunities, if you will, to save state dollars while balancing the budget. But they do come at a cost. Basically, if you do a payment shift, and we'll talk about this in more detail on Thursday, if you do a payment shift, you are basically asking we're delaying a payment to school districts. They still get the same amount over time, but we're forcing districts to do cash flow borrowing to get over the initial hurdle. So we're trading our deficit for a short-term shortfall on the district's end. And it's one time. It doesn't do anything for the structural problem. So we could hypothetically, let's say we did shifts equal to $1 billion, and we did that in fiscal 10. The books that would contribute to balancing the 10-11 budget, but it would do nothing for 12 and 13, and you'd be back in the soup again very quickly. So how do you come up with the $2 billion if you hypothetically did $1 billion for in shifts? The other alternative, another alternative, would be to change the aid levy balance in K-12. Districts would, in that kind of scenario, still have the same revenue, hypothetically, or you could even increase it. Let's get crazy. You could increase revenue to districts at the same time, but you're doing it on the backs of levy. In some respects, this is kind of what we did in 2003, but at a smaller level. We changed. Remember, the big plan in 2001 was to buy out the general education levy. In 2003, we backed off that a little and added about $100 million in levy and used that to help balance the state budget. These are levers that are available to school districts, to this committee, that other committees don't have. You can continue to deliver the same level of service, if you will, the same level of dollars to districts if you so choose, but it comes at the cost of increased property taxes. So $1 billion of property tax change in 2011 and a shift in 2010 get you $2 billion for this committee, and all of a sudden you've done your commitment. If you're comfortable with those kinds of property tax increases, that's an option. Because in the tail, the property tax changes would, depending on the policy solutions, generate $2 billion. So you've done your part. Work's done, right? But, of course, the tax committee is going to have concerns about who's paying those property taxes? Are there adjustments to the circuit breaker that need to occur to ensure that, on a policy level, the value of not having somebody get taxed out of their home? There are implications to those kinds of choices that we would all need to think about, which is why this committee ends up bringing its bill to the tax committee, so that they can make some tinkering, and the tax bill is usually the last bill out of Dodge, so to speak. And maybe that's a good point for me to pause and see if that generates some conversation, or if I'm at least heading in the direction that you'd like to converse about. And then after that, maybe I can go through some of the documents that are in front of you.
Thank you, Mr. Melman. Two questions that I have. One goes back to the revenue shortfall you mentioned for January. I missed that.
Mr. Chairman, we do get pretty regular updates on state revenues, and I should have said at the time, this is not a forecast. What this is a reporting of revenue collections, what actually comes in the door. It's not an alignment of spending with the revenues the way we get in November and February every year. What Minnesota Management and Budget reports is the estimate on the month on the November to December collections. They do this pretty regularly, and what actually came in. They were originally projecting $2.9 billion in estimated collections, and it came in at about 2.806. So the delta ends up being about $131 million of shortfall, the largest of which is $42 million in the corporate tax. Okay. So it's coming in below forecast, and I can tell you that all of the major tax groups are coming in beneath forecast, but it's really the corp tax that's of largest note. The variance was $57 million on the corp tax. Income was 39 and 33 on the sales. I looked at the wrong column.
The other question was, if you look at the total levy that we have in the state of Minnesota for education, what does that amount to?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like to follow along, this is a good point maybe to transition to some of the tracking sheet. This is the one that members are pretty familiar with, these E12 fiscal 2010-2011 budget. Property tax tracking for the November forecast. This takes us all the way back to taxes payable 2002, which is the year before the big plan buyout. And if you look at line, the second to the last page, 174. Total certified levies for fiscal year 2009, which is the current year that we are in, we're projecting $1.9 billion in total E12 levies. That includes debt service, it includes general fund, it includes the community service fund.
Thank you.
And you can see that line 175 shows the change each year. So if you look at fiscal 03, you see the big savings of $947 million, and then we've been creeping back up ever since.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nauman, on the, I don't mean to go back and forth too much here, but on the shift, just so my memory's clear, in 2003, is it fair to say that this committee, this division's piece of the budget solution was a shift plus levy?
We have a good chart on
it.
And we're going to give it to you on Thursday. I believe our target that year was $621 million of savings of cuts, if I'm remembering this correctly. And of that, just a minute.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'll show you this on Thursday. The shifts were about $436 million, $437 million. We converted about $21 million of state aid to property tax that year. And these are the numbers that we were projecting at the time. So once they finally closed up, they were a little bit different. We eliminated statutory growth factors. Members will recall, because we spent a lot of time talking about special ed, that was the year that we put the cap on special education. So it didn't cut special education, but it eliminated all the growth and then required the school districts to make the conversion. I know your interest is primarily shifts, but that was the big number. 70% of the K-12 solution that year was a shift. Then when you see the chart, I think it's kind of stark. In the next year, some of the percentage, I've grouped them into four categories that year: shifts, programmatic cuts, conversion of state aid, and the elimination of growth factors. And some of the percentages of how those kinds of choices change in the subsequent biennium, because the shifts become a much smaller percentage.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
How long did it take us to buy back the shift?
Well, this time, we'll give you this too, because you prompted the question the other day, so I went and did a bunch of research on it. It took us 2 years, and that's because we created in 2004 an automatic buyback. In law, we have a mechanism when the legislature essentially takes cash flow and reserve away, the minute the forecast goes positive again, when things improve, first thing we do is fill up the reserve, then we fill up the cash flow, and in 2004 we added pay back the shift. So in a sense, in the eyes of the law, we are using the K-12 shift mechanism as an additional reserve. School districts might not be very fond of that, but that is in fact how we used it in 2003. When we present the data to you, you'll see that in 1982, when the state was experiencing a substantial cash flow issue, we did a property tax recognition shift, and we'll talk about that in detail. But for now, we did a shift that saved, I think, about $240 million in that year. And we didn't pay that off fully until 1998. So our track record this time around was a lot better. And I would suggest that, and members may have feelings about this, but I would suggest the reason in aggregate terms that it got paid off quicker, number one, the economy turned around pretty quickly, but also members didn't have to take a vote each time on buying back the shift, which is the way it had to happen after 1982. And if things are positive, I would suggest that it's more interesting to do new legislative initiatives than it is to pay back the shift. So from a budgeteer's perspective, we tend to like the notion that the automatic buyback is part of the automatic fix. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Senator Bonhoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the shift, I know one of the problems that is causing the businesses to be in such trouble is the fact that the credit market has dried up. You know, that literally there's no money available for small businesses, for doing, mergers, all those types of things. Do we think that there would be any trouble for our school districts to have access to more borrowing?
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, that's probably a little above my pay grade. I could make an argument that could be the case. The money, the availability of credit is a lot tighter. However, school district bonds are backed by the taxpayers of each district, so I would think in most cases school districts would be a pretty good credit risk. That said, we'd have to really visit with a bondholder, the bond houses, to really get a good sense of what their sense of the risk is now. and that's not my area of expertise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Baugh.
Thank you. Another question, or actually just a comment that my school districts have come to me with, thinking that we might go down this path. They have expressed concern with regard to the automatic buyback of the shifts because they say, you know, regardless of how this all gets solved, there will not be additional resources coming into the classrooms because of what we're going through. And then if we shift, then that extends the years that they won't see new resources or new revenue. And so that's one of the concerns. So they have suggested, you know, if we do a shift, could you give a time period where, you know, we're kind of held harmless from paying it back? And I'm not saying I support that because I think there is benefit in paying it back right away, but I'm letting you know that that's some of the things being raised in the community.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, that's a perspective on the matter. The State Budget Trends Commission has recommended that we have a substantially larger reserve than we do. And as we talked about just a few moments ago, as we are, I mean, I'm not sure they contemplated that the state is effectively using the shift as in effect, a default to extra $1 billion of reserve. So if you buy the reserve as an important notion, then I would suggest that the policy question for members to think about is, when things go positive, is it just as important to pay back the shift so that you have it available to you the next time versus the urgency of getting more money, perhaps additional cash on the formula for school districts? There may be other ways on the levy side to give school districts additional revenue that would offset that need for them versus the overall policy that we've used. Another option would be to say, don't pay back the shift, but instead increase the amount that we're putting into the budget reserve and increase the amount that we're putting into the cash flow and say, okay, we're just going to leave that shift there and just call it a wash. As a K-12 person, I would argue that paying back that shift is probably good, prudent policy so that this committee has that lever again in the future. Pay that debt off before you move forward. But there's definitely an issue there for districts and members to think about.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the opportunity to have a kind of a general discussion about just the lay of the land and where we might want to go. And I think that shifts are something that we ought to contemplate. But I think, Mr. Nauman, as you pointed out, that is a short-term solution. You do it and you get that benefit and you may be able to balance your budget in the short term, but it doesn't solve the problem. And if we are in an economic circumstance that may go out for a few years and nobody knows, then we do have that problem that we'll have to address without having the opportunity to do more shifting. And so I think we ought to contemplate that and see what we can do that makes sense. But the other thing I'd like to offer to the committee to think about is, Mr. Nauman, you pointed out that 80% or so of the money that we spend in this committee goes to general fund. And if you add the special education, it's 90 or something. So it's a significant portion. And of that general fund dollars, when you look at budgets that school districts deal with, about 80% of those general fund are people costs, salary, benefit costs. And I think that's the thing that we need to think about, is that if we do not have resources, either in this budget period or the next, or if we're looking at some structural shortage of funds, I think it's very important that we contemplate how local school districts are going to deal with that. And I think the reality is right now that the structure would say that whatever we do here doesn't necessarily translate into reduced expenses at school district levels. They still have obligations through their contractual bargained arrangements with their employees to have their costs go up. And I just think that if we're going to get serious about dealing with this in a structural way, we have to contemplate what can we do, what can we offer to school districts to give them flexibility through whatever the period might be, the next 2 years, or maybe it's 4 years, so that they don't have to deal with limited money And the only option they have to address that is looking at substantial layoffs of staff or reduction in programs, which is about the same thing. And so I think that as we wrestle with the budget, I think we ought to look at, are there tools that we can offer to local school districts to help them manage a problem that is going to end up in their lap? If we don't have money to give them the resources to meet the contractual obligations they have, what are their options going to be? And we can, yes, we can look at increased levies, and that does have that potential of offering some additional resources, but they may not be successful at getting those additional resources. There may be tax committee constraints that say that's not a realistic choice either. So I just think that if we look at, again, and Mr. Nauman made the point that K-12 is a big part of the state budget, and Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that too. If we're going to deal with this problem, we're going to have to deal with K-12. But the big part of K-12 are the people costs. And how are we going to manage that more effectively? How can we give some ability to school districts to manage that in a realistic way so that they do not have increased costs, even if we were able to hold ours flat? And I just want to throw that on the table here as we talk about what we can do to look at the structural constraints that we have put in place, and can we find a way to give some relief in the short term to not have the local school districts deal with this in a very draconian way.
Mr. Allen, do we know exactly what that would you call that, Senator Hand, the inflation?
Well,
or automatic inflation?
It's called inflation, but these are bargained agreements that are made by all the districts, and I'm hesitant to call them inflation because they're conscious decisions that people make, and they make commitments that go out into the future 2 years, and they say we are going to increase our cost to our staff by whatever it might be, either through the lanes and steps mechanism or through cost of living adjustments or increased in health care benefits or whatever they might be. The whole package is a contractual agreement that requires that they pay those things. And that's the way the world works. And so if we say there's no money and you have those agreements, the only way you can solve that is to reduce the number of people that you have that agreement with. And that's the result. And I've seen that happen as a school board member at various times. And I think that we ought to have more options than just that available to local schools. That's my point.
What I've seen happen is that many of those agreements, and I would imagine quite often those agreements, some of those agreements at least come in before we actually end our legislative session. So it's tough, I would imagine, as a school board member to know what the legislature will do. And it's also difficult for us to know what those costs are, I suppose, because we don't anticipate those costs so much. It's kind of the school board is kind of the go-between, you know, between the legislature and the agreement or the personnel. So I think we have a general inflationary assumption, but I'm not sure it takes that district inflation into account.
Mr. Chairman, just to that point, I think most, and I'm not an economist, but I think most would agree that we are not in a period of inflation right now. And some even would say that we're in a deflation, or who knows what the circumstance will be. And I think that we have to look at the structure we have created that I think creates great inflexibility in terms of choices that local schools, local parents through their school boards can exercise in doing the best they can to provide good education for their children. And I think because we have the power in this committee at the state level to have a say about how that structure ought to look. Yes, let's do what we need to do in the short term to balance the budget, but let's try to look at that long term and create mechanisms by which this can be done more flexibly so that if this extends further than the next budget period, that we do not have to come back and look at one choice, which is massive layoffs potentially of people who are serving our kids in schools.
Okay, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. we talk about this in terms of numbers and who's going to spend what, but we also have another pressure on the school districts, and that is the constant ramping up of our expectations of what we want from our school districts. I was reading an article the other day that in Indiana, they spend $45 million on their testing, but the hidden cost to Indiana school districts is $450 million in remedial education. And so I was talking to my own school district, and you know, just the students who did not pass the reading or literacy or whatever they call the grad tests that they take in 10th grade, that they will spend $78,000 mostly on students who have come into the district after ninth grade or at ninth grade. And so we have a hidden cost to the districts in terms of our expectations. And so all those things have to factor in. The personnel issues are, again, we hear from everywhere, the McKenzie report, other reports, that teacher quality is key to changing the achievement of students. And yet, you know, we have this, how are we going to attract people to the profession and keep them in the profession? So we've got pressures on the school districts from all sides that are we have to take into account.
Senator Dahl?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to comment on Senator Hahn was saying. Even I'm sure there'll be some districts that will be negotiating and probably a 0-0 or a 0-1 or whatever it may be. And if we consider perhaps what you're talking about, probably steps and lanes is like an automatic increase, that might be fine if health insurance costs did not go up. When we've negotiated in the past a 0% increase, maybe a 0-2, that year we got the 0, there were many teachers that went backwards. So there's no assumption that most districts will automatically get an increase just because of steps and lanes. If health insurance did not go up, and most of the contracts that I have negotiated has been double digits every year, you know, that would be something they probably could live with. But even a 0-0, most teachers would go backwards with the step and lane increases.
Well, when we talk about inflation, I think there it depends on what level you actually talk about inflation. I mean, overall, it might be a wash, you know, that we're not actually the economy is not inflating, but some segments of the economy prices are going up. Obviously, if you go to the grocery store or the supermarket, you realize that food prices have gone up, or you know, the fluctuation in energy prices. So the figure, Mr. Nauman, a question for you is the figure that I've heard, and maybe it's not correct now, but was about $650 million for inflation of the state's general fund budget. Is that accurate or close, or is that?
You mean, Mr. Chairman, relative to the forecast, how much would the inflationary estimate would be if inflation were included?
Right.
Yeah, I have that number in the. Probably should have it off the top of my brain, but.
And then a follow-up would be: is where is that inflation found? Yeah. If salaries, is it just a certain number added to this general fund?
Inflation for fiscal 10 and 11, were it included in the forecast, would be $650 million. And then, of course, it compounds. So if it were, and plotting that to fiscal 12 and 13 is $1.5 billion. As for where it's found, I think the way to think about this is it's a mathematical calculation based on the existing size of the budget. So if you assume a reasonable percentage increase based on cost of living numbers that the Department of Management and Budget are using, those are the projected inflation. Members will recall that I believe it was in the 2002 session, this used to be part of the forecast. And that in 2002, part of the way we balanced out the out years that year was to say we're repealing inflation. And we repealed it from the forecast and process.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Going back to what Senator Dahl mentioned about the zero and zero being, you know, perhaps a step backwards, I think that's probably the case. Yet I also think that anybody who's in that situation would prefer to have a little less when they're trying to make ends meet than not be working. And so I think that we have to keep that in mind as we look at what our options are. You know, as these companies are laying people off, you can't help but think, gosh, if there was any way they could go to a, you know, a four-day work week versus a layoff. I mean, those of us who have gone through bad times, and everybody does, it's, you know, nobody's immune from it. We all know that having some income coming in is everything. And so I think we have to, in these tough times, keep that in mind, that if we can protect layoffs, you know, that's our responsibility.
Is a shorter year or a shorter week options for K-12? I mean, I Senator Rummel mentioned the pressures of testing. I mean, on the one hand, we're trying to increase the quality and the outcome. On the other hand, we're trying to reduce or figure out how we might reduce expenditures. Senator Salzman?
I think on healthcare, the thing that if we were looking at public employees as having to take a higher hit on healthcare than what's happening in the private sector, because, you know, in my experience in talking with people, this is happening in private companies as well, where people are, it's maybe not a salary issue, but they're paying more for premiums, or as they're negotiating, or they're paying higher deductibles. So I think in terms of healthcare, again, I think in this particular climate, it's going to be very important for us to, you know, look at this in a very broad way of what's happening in both the private sector to the people who are paying the bill, and what's happening with our public employees. And we're going to have to work on this together. And I think that's where we have to be very careful, because we have to look at who's paying the bill for this. And it's people who are losing their jobs or also having to pay more for health care. And they're not real sympathetic. A lot of us are getting ideas from constituents who I think are very reasonable, and they're asking us to look at these kind of issues. So I think to just take it off the table, I really applaud your efforts to look at everything today. I think that that's the most responsible thing that we can do. Not to say that, and I think, you know, to all of us, sometimes we think out loud, and then later on everybody is like, what were you thinking? And, you know, I think we need to be thinking out loud and have the courage to do that.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the length of the academic year question, I've actually been going in the other direction, that we need to lengthen it because of the increased demands, the testing, the AP tests particularly. But I know some of these numbers from memory. I think they're still holding true, that the average length of the school year in the country is about 180 days, and our average length is 170. So you could argue that Minnesota schools are doing as much or better than other schools, and we're already short 2 weeks. So in the spirit of having everything on the table, I think it's an important discussion, but boy, I'd put that one a lot lower on the desirability list.
The reason I mentioned it, Senator Michelle, was that somebody mentioned that some state,
California
was, oh, you, I believe, mentioned that. I don't know what the savings was, but last year we saw some districts, school districts, that went to a four-day school week to try to save money. Obviously, it creates problems, too. I'm sure in many cases that could mean, you know, child care issues for some families. It could mean, you know, I don't know what the savings actually would be, but and then it probably would not
mean an accrued savings to the state.
Right.
I don't think.
Right, so Mr. Chairman, that does become an important issue. I mean, we don't pay based on the day. So it might be a rationale for making a reduction, but you would have to make that linkage. I mean, Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, Senator Hand brought up the notion of the one-time nature of shifts, and since I'd encourage you also to be, as you're talking through this, to be thinking about budget solutions in this particular budget area, how do you feel about shifts, I think, is an important question to think about. From a budget perspective, making a shift in combination with a structural change that you can't make until the second year. Members are all very conversant with the notion that any levy changes that we make don't take effect until the second year. So that's an occasion where doing a one-time shift gets you over the hump until your structural change takes effect. That might be a good occasion to do it. Doing a shift to bankroll a formula increase would be one that I would suggest is less than prudent. So I think that those might be ways to think about what is the basis on which you're making a shift and do it with your eyes open as opposed to, oh, my goodness, this is our solution.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the only other thing that I thought would be useful that would maybe save a little bit of time on Thursday would be to perhaps go through some of the documents that you have in front of you. I think most of the members on this committee are familiar with what we've got here, but it might be a good refresher because the mind tends to wander, at least mine does during the interim. So I think we have them in order, but you may have moved them around since we began. The first document I'll call to your attention is the E-12 Fiscal 10-11 Budget Appropriation Tracking End of Session versus November Forecast. It's a legal-sized document. This is the bread and butter of this committee. This is the aid spending general fund, all the accounts that we look at. The EOS is end of session. That's where you all left us when you when we completed the session. The November forecast is the new changes. And I think it's interesting to note that end of session relative to the forecast in fiscal year 2008 and 9 actually went down. Lower pupil counts and a reduced referendum assumption are the primary drivers behind that. You see that line 181. November forecast minus EOS. It's right in the center of the page. And again, the reduced referendum and pupil counts also show a reduction in fiscal 10 and 11. So I think that's useful to see. Through the end of the projection, the K-12 budget is projected to grow to up to $14.3 billion. So we're getting bigger.
Question that, Mr. Chair?
Senator Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say there's an assumption about operating levies, is there an assumption that they will not be approved, reapproved, or is?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, generally we take the department's estimate unless we have a good reason not to. And in every budget, we make assumptions about sort of the passage rate of operating referendum in the aggregate. And the 10-year average tends to be about a 66-67% passage rate. Some years it's higher, some years it's lower. And that tends to be the work of the department. And then, of course, it's an issue of aid levy mix. Where are those districts passing? Where are they not? Some years we tend to do a little bit better job than others. For example, in a year when you're putting a huge amount of formula out there, maybe there's reduced pressure on the operating referendum. Fewer districts need to actually go out. Conversely, I would suggest that one thing for us to think about would be if we were to take $100 off the formula this year as part of a budget balancing effort, you would logically assume, oh, we're going to get $100 in, or $100 million in savings. However, that would create pressure on districts to go out for referendum. So I think that the fiscal staff would need to have a conversation with Dr. Melcher and how would we what could we really book? Do we need to make an assumption about increased referenda? In the last 5-6 years, we have just held the assumption flat. But in this environment, depending on what the policy choices are, we might be coming back to you and saying you're not going to be able to collect all of that we think that there might be some referendum assumption that we ought to build in that kind of an environment. So that's a good point.
Mr. Chair, was
Senator Salzman.
It's not just an issue of you know, districts going out for more, that there's an anticipation that some districts will lose what they have.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, I realize that's what you asked, and I answered the question I was more comfortable answering.
Absolutely. I just wanted to summarize what I took from that. You don't need to respond.
What I can tell you is we don't get that specific. We just make a growth assumption in the forecast, and it is for expansion. Because we're not getting down to the district-by-district level at that point, we're not saying, oops, Stillwater is not going to re-up the referendum. We're not doing anything like that. So that's the aid document. I've already highlighted the property tax tracking for you. That's the one that has the extra zero on the this version. Members are familiar with that. And again, it does go back to the year before the buyout, which I think is useful because it does show you some trends. At some point, I'm going to run out of space as we keep adding years, but that's interesting too. Then I think because there are a whole bunch of calculations that go into the general education model, we periodically show you this document, and this is the entitlement document. This is before we do the 90-10 calculations on the payments, and it just is the straight entitlements out of the model. So if we make a model change in the Senate bill, for example, it will show you that you add $100 to the formula, it'll show you that. It'll also show you the pass-through if you allow that to occur under compensatory transportation sparsity and sparsity. And the way the boxes are aligned for you here, it's November versus November, so everything on the difference is shown as zero. It's just our starting point. But this is a document we'll bring to you periodically as the need occurs. The next one I have in my pile is just the front page of a summary document. When bills come before you, sometimes it calls for a summary, and we will have that. This is Senator Bonoff's bill from the other day. You've seen it. You've seen the whole thing. We're just giving you the front page here just as a reminder. Fiscal notes look like this. Periodically, we'll give you bring fiscal notes on some bills. Most of the finance bills do require them, and we usually like to double check them on mostly for the levy side. We can usually model up the state aid. Data runs, sometimes the most favorite document that we have. This one is the data run that shows the final permanent school trust fund subtraction elimination from last year's K-12 bill. I believe it's still current. And then I think I skipped over one document, and the fiscal status category sort. Usually when you've got a collection of money bills in front of you, we'll try to the best of our ability at the time that the hearing occurs, just plot out totals by bill. And most of the time it's coming straight off the fiscal note, but at least it gives you a summary of, you got $123 million on your agenda today, that kind of thing. So those are the documents that we generally, by course, will bring you. Of course, these will evolve and change as the session proceeds, adding additional columns, subtracting some that were no longer necessary. So, Mr. Chairman, that's all I had.
Mr. Nauman, one of the topics that was brought up today, Senator Rummel brought up, when we make pass a bill or do something in the legislature, quite often drives local costs that may or may not be calculated into the overall cost. And I think for state governments, there's a kind of a local government calculation. But do we have any aspect of our budget that entails tracking what the local cost might be that's driven by
state legislation?
Mr. Chairman, in a formal way, there is a process, but it's not used terribly often. A local impact note can be generated. And it hasn't been used that often out of this committee. But there is a process, and I think it has to be requested. I better check the law, but I think the finance chair has to formally actually request. Let me pause. And there is a structure and an individual in the legislature that formally requests it in order for that to occur. But it hasn't been something that we do routinely.
The reason I mention that is that I think many committees, many finance committees, are concerned, and as legislators meet with their local units of government, there's concern at that level as well that mandates or flexibility in dealing with some kind of a reduction in funds would be helpful. And so I think that we have to be more conscious about what we end up doing at the state level, whether it's the legislation that's passed by the legislature or rules that are generated by agencies. Because quite often there's an initial cost, but there's that kind of that multiple effect out there. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think...
Mr. Chairman, I know that there has been at least one or two K-12 bills in the last year where a local impact note has been requested, and I remember that in some of the discussions with the agencies as they were going through that, it frequently involves an informal surveying of local school districts or, in some cases, counties or cities. It's far less precise than the fiscal note process, not to imply that... There's a lot of precision in our fiscal notes, but it does give us a basis to tying a number that we feel a lot more comfortable with than we would, $123 million local impact note might vary. The variance would be much higher because of the lack of precision.
Okay. Well, members, any other questions? If not, we're going to meet on Thursday, and then we'll have the presentation that we were supposed to have today. Oh, thank you. Committee
thank
is adjourned.
You.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Weaver.
I was just going to mention that the QCOMP report is going to be available on February 3rd from the legislative audit.
Oh, good.
Keep your information.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Allman.
I've just been emailed. The ranking member of